Today on Around the Coin, I interview Scott Dykstra, the CTO and co-founder of Space and Time, as well as Prandar Das, who is the CEO and co-founder of Sotero. The two companies work very closely together, so we thought it would be appropriate to have them both on the conversation. Space and Time has raised over $30 million at a $300 million valuation, close partnership with Microsoft, over 50 people, and they've made great progress to decentralize and provide encryption across data warehouses. We talked about how the two companies help with data privacy and security and what the emerging world of servers, networks, security looks like in a both decentralized and centralized world. We talked about the influence of their technology on this rising tension between Bitcoin and the US dollar, the sort of conflict between the Federal Reserve and the ability to control the US dollar over the free-flowing value in cryptocurrency. And we speculate a little bit as to where things go. It was a really interesting conversation, and I hope you enjoy. All right, Scott, Prandar, I'm excited to have you guys on and talk about your space and time in DeFi. Why don't we kick off the conversation with a little bit of your personal backgrounds on why you started the project and what you are trying to accomplish in the world? Maybe Scott, I'll point it to you. What were you doing before Space and Time? And then what are you trying to accomplish with this organization?
Absolutely. Let's get right into it. Mike, thanks for having us and definitely excited to be here. Spent about a decade in enterprise data warehousing, building 500 terabyte scale databases for the Fortune 500. It was really the opposite of what I'm doing at Space and Time in terms of centralizing the world's data into large kind of analytic black boxes, tamperable, centralized, massive data warehouses in the cloud controlled by large organizations, mainly the Fortune 500. Great chance to learn about how data performs at that scale, how to organize data at that scale, and how to solve analytic kind of challenges at that scale. But I think entering the world of Web3 and DeFi and seeing, you know, how blockchain has evolved over the last 5 years was a chance to see that there's really a unique opportunity for someone, hopefully Space and Time, to bring in a new kind of paradigm for processing data at extreme scale, on a global scale, where the constituents of that data, the owners of that data, the users of these protocols won't have to just give up control of their personal data. And also the builders, the developers that are building protocols in this can actually have confidence that their data is tamper-proof and has been processed in a way that is truly decentralized, community-operated, community-owned, and most importantly, kind of proofed, ZK-proof. So Space and Time is building not just a data warehouse that removes the centralization of the world's data to these analytic black boxes in the cloud and decentralizes the world's data, but more importantly, provides proofs to developers that their data hasn't been tampered with and that the computations against their data are accurate. Their SQL has been executed in a verifiable way.
Is this not possible? Because when you say you're putting this valuable data everywhere in a decentralized way, the immediate thought is there's more surface area for attack. But you complement that by saying there's these ZK proofs and they're encrypted. Could you not have a system that has it all in one place? You gain the efficiency, I'm sure it's easier to manage if you just have one server. Could you not have that one server be safe with these encryption methods?
I think there are plenty of organizations that have done a decent job locking down their data into a, like you said, centralized single point of control in the cloud or on-premise. And a lot of those organizations are doing just fine in Web 2 and haven't experienced breaches or haven't controlled their data and locked it down in, like, for example, a SOC 2 compliant way. But that's just the problem. In DeFi, what's on-chain, smart contracts on-chain, need to know that the processing of data off-chain was done by multiple parties in a verifiable way with verifiable computations. And if you lock down data into a centralized database in the cloud or on-premise, sure, you might have your own firewall behind that data. But how can a smart contract on the blockchain or any protocol related to Web3, for that matter, know that owners of that analytic black box, the owners of that single point of control, the owners of that centralized database, aren't just logging in and changing a few rows of data and basically tampering with the entire data pipeline to and from the chain.
Got it. Okay. So this effectively relies on distribution of control. And by not having the control being in one place, you can increase the likelihood that the data has not been tampered with. Is there a conflict when, even though you might have multiple instances, it's still under the purview of a government? Like, for instance, if you had, 12 different data centers, it seems distributed, but if they're all in the United States, ultimately the federal government could go in and just shut them all down at once or take all the data. Or is there some other viewpoint at which this still is a concern?
Yeah, what you're getting at is censorship resistance, which really is the last thing to touch on here. And censorship resistance is not just about having a number of parties process the data or available to compute on data. It's about globally distributing the nodes, the servers that hold this data and process it in a global network of user-operated, user-owned nodes, community-operated, community-owned data warehousing. Something never really been done before, as far as I know. That invites not just proofs that things are tamper-proof, but it invites censorship resistance of data. It makes it harder for data to be deleted, makes it harder for data to be, for computations on data to be locked down. So I think that's a huge benefit. It's kind of a side effect of decentralizing your data is you invite some censorship resistance. And then finally, I think just the idea alone that you've decentralized your data across a global network of user-operated nodes also gives you infinite availability, extremely high availability that you don't get from a single centralized server in the cloud or on-premise.
Interesting. The first thing I thought of when I heard the name Space and Chime was that there's some actual space happening. So I was like, oh, are these guys maybe sending servers to outer space and then having like orbital? What do you think about that? I mean, do you think that's in the next 10 years where there'll be data centers in space because that's, resistant to government intervention?
I think the cost per compute would be a little high, right? Where everyone's very, very, at extreme scale when processing terabytes or even petabytes of data, most organizations' first question is, what the heck is that going to cost me? So I think if you move that data center up to space, maybe those costs would be challenging. But hey, there's plenty of use cases for it. We see Starlink orbiting the planet every night, look up at the stars, and you see a line of satellites bringing internet to the globe. And if I'm running a query in the outback, theoretically, I could be on my phone on Starlink in the outback executing queries and getting back answers from space and time. So, I mean, crazy idea, but I love it.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, if as long as you had the solar panel set up and you had the capacitors to store energy, there's plenty of energy up there. You just need to ship these things up there. Prandar, I'd love to hear your thoughts on the company. So you guys have raised $30 million. I saw roughly $300 million valuation last year, 50 people, Microsoft got involved. What do you view the strategic direction of the business going forward?
Mike, I'm the founder of Sotero. We are a Boston-based startup focusing on data security. The early parts of this conversation, I think you kind of touched on a lot of the reasons why we started Sotero. The centralized database or data warehouse where a lot of data is moved into security. In some ways, it's operational today, but not really effective or efficient. And the challenges with trying to move data into a centralized location is obviously you're attempting to build a very secure location that has very limited access. Limited access itself is a problem, right? If it's data, it needs to be available broadly for access and use. That's the value of data. So trying to put this into a centralized location, limiting access goes against what you want to do with your data. That's fundamentally one of the challenges. The other one is the latency. Data is valuable when you can operate on it and act on it as quickly as possible. Any latency diminishes the value of data. Current security products don't really enable you to achieve business outcomes in real time. They put barriers.
Let me just take a step back for a second. So just to be clear, you're running a company called Sotero, separate from Time and Space and Time. maybe give me a little background on how these businesses overlap and how you got here.
Yeah, so I mean, my background is very similar to Scott's. I built data warehouses, but from a different perspective. I worked for marketing companies that enable businesses to market to people. So we built all those terabyte, petabyte-sized databases that are responsible for a bulk of the messaging you receive, whether it's on the web, direct mail, or email, text messaging. We were doing all of those. It's great for businesses to drive revenue and opportunity, right? But when you look at it from a perspective of consumer privacy or even privacy and security, there's very little of that there. You're essentially kind of building platforms that violate privacy or security. And looking at it from a technology perspective, really, there weren't many solutions or there weren't any solutions that enable businesses to operate, but still enable consumers' privacy to be respected. That was the genesis for us to start Zotero, building a data security product that enabled the preservation of privacy, but also enabled quick and real-time access to organizations to drive their businesses. That was a gap that we spotted. And as Scott was talking about the decentralized data warehouse, and I think Scott kind of positions this really effectively, right? When you're talking about a decentralized data warehouse or data nodes, you're not talking about data nodes or databases that are within your control. You're firing them up on platforms or servers that are in somebody else's control. So the whole notion of tying down databases behind a firewall doesn't exist anymore. How do you do that? How do you distribute data across millions of nodes but still preserve privacy? That's the partnership between us. Between us, they built the framework to be able to distribute data, compute across millions of nodes in real time effectively. We kind of give them the capability to preserve the privacy and the security of the data across those millions of nodes. That's the partnership.
Yeah, one of the reasons I'm so excited to have Piranda and the Zotero team supporting Space and Time is we really couldn't do this without them. What Piranda is highlighting is that Zotero enables Space and Time to be a truly decentralized data warehouse, while also maintaining privacy and encryption, as Prandar so elegantly put it. On the blockchain, most data is public. Sure, there are encrypted keys and there's encrypted data sets that a smart contract can decrypt. But in general, we think about blockchain data as a public data set. We think about decentralized data as public data. And there are plenty of Space and Time developers, our customers, our partners, our developer community that are building with public data. And we encourage that. But simultaneously, there are plenty of customers, partners, and developers in this space that don't want all or some of their data to be public. They need privacy in some cases. Think about like risk scores or credit scores that are going on chain. Think about financial markets that involve private third parties and auditors that think about proof of reserve and exchanges and banks sharing private information and public information. I think there's a use case for both. We highly encourage public, unencrypted, fully world access data. That's great. We want open source data. But at the same time, there are plenty of use cases. Healthcare, for example, HIPAA compliance, where data cannot be public. And if you want to bring those use cases on chain, what do you do? Well, you need a way to connect all that data to the chain, to smart contracts. And how do you connect it to smart contracts? In a tamper-proof or ZK-proofed way? Well, Space and Time. But if Space and Time is a global network of decentralized nodes, who are operating those nodes? Well, a global community of miners, of node operators, just like Ethereum, just like Bitcoin. But unlike Ethereum and Bitcoin, there might be healthcare data that's stored at scale. There might be private banking or third-party auditor data. There might be credit scores stored on Space and Time. And that's where Zotero comes in. Zotero allows us to encrypt that data in the database itself, not just on the disk, but actually at the column level, encrypt that data before it's sent out to this network, so the operators of these nodes can't manipulate, steal, or unencrypt that data and kind of use it for non-compliant purposes.
Okay, that was a good explanation. Let me ask maybe what's the dumb question, but why would, I'm trying to get a better sense of like the boundary condition here. So why would Space and Time not have a function or feature to encrypt the data on the, like you said, the column level in the database?
Oh, well, this is one that Prander's going to have a great answer for, but I'll give a really quick answer and hand it over to him because it's really, really hard.
Okay.
Space and Time is tackling enough massive challenges as it is the last challenge that I want to go tackle is in database encryption. Well, we're not talking about on-disk encryption. Sure, that's solved. A few lines of code and a few Python functions and we can encrypt on disk. The cloud, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, they all encrypt on disk. What Parander has built is something truly unique in that it actually encrypts data at the column level in the database, which is extremely challenging to do. I'll let Parander.
And just before Parander, before you even dive in, just to clarify, on disk versus on column or on database, this means like the data itself, if I have access to the database, if it's encrypted on disk, that's less desirable because I can still see the data in the database. But
exactly.
Maybe help me better understand that.
So, Mike, I mean, you put it very well, right? I mean, everybody, it's widely misunderstood. People say we encrypt our data on disk and we're good. It actually does nothing from a database or a usage perspective, because when somebody accesses the database, the data is completely visible. The on-disk encryption is preventing somebody from making a copy of the disk or making a copy of the file. Beyond that, it provides nothing. The flip side of the challenge is when you encrypt attributes or columns within the database, you immediately lose functionality because you can't run queries on data. Our patented technology is the ability to run queries on encrypted attributes. So you lose no functionality, you lose no performance, but you preserve the privacy or the security of the data, because now somebody logging into the database without authorization sees nothing.
And so
that's the value proposition that we bring.
Is this basically, and maybe it's difficult to explain this in basic terms, but is your algorithm an algorithm to decrypt the information and run a query and then re-encrypt it? So how can you run a query on encrypted data?
That's the big difference. So the how can you run a query question is academically answered fairly easily, right? There's a notion of encryption, a homomorphic encryption that in theory provides the ability to query any encrypted data. The problem with homomorphic encryption is that it's performance intensive and really not practical at all. Several universities and organizations, the big ones, have all tried at it, but have not been able to crack that problem. We actually, that's where our technology lies. That's where our patent is. And we've been able to develop technology that enables the querying of encrypted attributes without the need to decrypt them. So in our scenario, you have database in one of those nodes. You have a database that's hosted on a node. You have data in there. We've gone in there and encrypted the attribute. The queries running against that will run on encrypted attributes. They don't need to decrypt it to actually run a query.
Yeah, and so okay. Think about it. What it really comes down to is encrypting everything and then not being able to actually process that, or encrypting the data that actually needs to be encrypted, like a phone number or a credit card number or some healthcare information or some private banking numbers, the books, encrypting the data that needs to be encrypted, and then being able to actually operate and run complex queries, run space and time's business on that data. That's very different than just encrypting on disk, where everything gets unencrypted before you process it, and then it kind of defeats the whole purpose.
Right.
Then you move to a future we see of enclave, trusted execution environment-based compute. The problem there is you can't run a massively parallel, massively scalable Kubernetes cluster of data warehouse nodes in one little enclave in the cloud, right? I love the future of confidential compute that like clouds like Microsoft Azure are bringing to the table, where you can actually run computations in a completely encrypted VM. But unfortunately, they're very expensive and they don't scale to a data warehouse scale. We're talking about terabytes or petabytes of data. That's why we need Zotero. And then what we can do then is we can connect encrypted data to smart contracts. We've developed a ZK proof for SQL so that we can prove that our SQL execution was done correctly and that nobody has actually changed the data or manipulated the data. So Zotero can prove that the data remained encrypted. So you combine encryption with a ZK proof of the actual computation on the data. And what do you have? You have the next generation of secure computation for smart contracts.
Interesting. Oh, let me just make sure I get this Zotero concept. So there's so you said academically, Parander, the ability to run any sort of query, say like, okay, give me everybody who lives in Oregon, right, in my database. To run that kind of query, you're basically looking for the word Oregon and your yep. return program that has that. So it's scanning everyone and then it's quickly saying, is it these characters or not? Yes or no. And then it creates a list. That's what we mean by querying. In encryption, there's like a 26 randomized character and the algorithm would look at that character, that string of characters and say, is it an Oregon? It sounds like a little bit of black magic to me, but I also really have no clue what I'm talking about. How is it? I mean, could you even describe a little bit in simplistic terms of how this works?
So, obviously without going into too much of the technical details, because that is probably not very appealing or interesting to somebody that's listening to this, right? I mean, the query that you brought out, if you look at a variant of that query and say, give me all the people that whose names have OR in them. Right, that's a much more complex query than just saying, give me all the people that live in Oregon, because that could be, in some cases, a fairly straightforward string match. So when you have partial matches, that's a range query or a like query. That requires a lot of complexity in how the query is executed. We actually, when we encrypt the data, we build an intelligence into the attributes so that our algorithms can go in there and scan them to identify the various combinations. And it's not just a fixed combination, right? When you think about all the permutations and combinations in a name itself that you have to match, that's the intelligence we build into our encrypted tokens so that we can go in there and query them.
So would it be accurate to say you're looking for patterns across the encrypted data? And that
any query is, any search query is patterns, right? In many ways, that's essentially the gist of the solution.
So, but at the same time, it's not de-encrypting it. It's just looking for the pattern.
It's not de-encrypting. None of the data. So that's one of the other challenges with encryption, right? You either have server-side encryption or client-side encryption. Server-side encryption is what you're saying. It's like decrypt the data, stage it, plain text, run the query, get the results, and then encrypt the data again. That's a lot of overhead and really provides no protection because you don't think of databases that are sitting idle, right? They're being used all the time. So the data, for the most part, is staged in plain text. And that's the vulnerability that any query that's coming in has access. That's what we solve.
Something that's helpful to understand too is like space and time set out to connect SQL query results directly to smart contracts in a tamper-proof way, in a decentralized, trustless way. Thankfully, SQL, as complex as it is a kind of a limited scope. It's a walled boundary. It's not just arbitrary compute. You know, it's not like, you know, I can't go write like a, you know, 4,000 Python script that has just an arbitrary computation. SQL does have a kind of a limited set of computations, where clauses, aggregations, you know, group by, sorts, order by, you know, those kind of aggregations, filters. It's got a walled boundary of the different types of computations it does. Thankfully, that allowed space and time to develop a novel ZK proof. Literally ZK SQL, proof we call proof of SQL, that proves that our computations were done, correct? It also allowed the Sotero team, led by Parander, to build all the kind of the operations they need to do on encrypted data within that walled boundary of SQL. It's extremely complicated. I wouldn't want to take on that encryption challenge. I'll leave that to Parander and team. But it because it's a walled boundary and not just arbitrary, random, anything goes, it allowed us to build a ZK proof and allowed him to build encryption that can actually operate on that encrypted data. SQL operates on that encrypted data.
Okay, so if we move back up, like think about this from like a higher level abstract sense, you have the ability to say, like I even think of, you mentioned healthcare data, even if I go and buy a coffee at a coffee shop, that if I pay with Bitcoin and the coffee shop knows my Bitcoin address, they can see all my transaction history, they can see how much is in my Bitcoin wallet. So that's not ideal. If you have the ability to have all that information private, and then the private aspect means space and time sends it to a bunch of different servers, and then it's encrypted all the way down so that no one can hack it at any point. That's like basically the value proposition, right?
Yeah.
The
value prop that space and time brings to the table is we can prove that the data we're handing to a smart contract, the query results that we're handing to a smart contract, are accurate, verifiable, and have not been manipulated. The value that Sotero brings to the table is ensuring that hackers aren't stealing that data when it's being moved around.
Gotcha. Okay. And so the primary, when you think about this and you get excited to build this feature, who do you immediately look at and say, you're going to benefit? Is it Microsoft when they host like big servers? Is it future companies that have yet to be built? Who's like the first low-hanging fruit customer you approach? Maybe.
No, I'm let me take a shot at answering that question. I mean, I think part of what we've not discussed about, and I think, I mean, Scott has it in the back of his mind, what they're building is going to be the future of data warehousing, if that's even the right phrase for it. The whole notion of centralizing or collect a data collection, putting it into a centralized server, processing it, getting the results and applying the results to some system that's not connected to it, I think it's going to go away. The amount of effort, compute resources, and effort, time involved in data collection, but cleaning it, processing it, staging it, operating it, running analytics on it, and pushing the results out, it's not sustainable given the volume of data and the amount of devices that are popping up. A framework like what Space and Time is building is the future, whether it's for smart contracts today or decentralized data warehousing in the future. That's that's the paradigm that's going to emerge out of it. So keeping data secure across the entire transaction is critical, which is what the Space and Time platform provides. Keeping data protected as it's stored and operated on is what we bring to the table.
Got it. Okay. So I'm clear on that. Is this, does it have to be, do you use the word decentralized? I mean, you have it right in your description, or is it just redundant? I mean, if you had three data warehouses that each had the same information on them, is that decentralized? Is too decentralized? Like, what do you think realistically we converge at? Is 100 like,
yeah. I think that's a very valid question. What we set out to do and what we're going to continue to do all throughout this year is add more and more user-operated data warehouse clusters across the globe. I don't think three data warehouses, all owned by Space and Time Inc., is decentralized. To your point, that's redundant. And a lot of folks would, in the space, wrongly probably call that decentralized when you just have a few nodes in a little mini network. And that's a private network. That's still very centralized. What we're building is something that's community owned and operated, like Ethereum, right? Where anyone across the globe, Mike himself, can spin up a Space and Time cluster, either in his own data, either in his basement or in the cloud, right? And then contribute that cluster back to the Space and Time network and receive a token payment, a token incentive for the work that his cluster does. What we aim to have is a couple hundred nodes at least across the globe, in the same way that like Polygon might have a couple hundred validators across the globe, as an example. I think a couple hundred is enough to begin censorship resistance. It's not perfect, certainly not Ethereum or certainly not Bitcoin level of censorship resistance. I think there are still challenges there. I think there's further decentralization needed, and that's where the ZK proof comes in. We realize that just having a network of user operated nodes across the globe is not adequate. There's another technology you need to add on to that, which is a zero knowledge proof that the computation of all those 200 clusters across the globe are doing the right computations, are not manipulating the data. And when we send data to smart contracts, especially, we have to be 100% sure that we're sending the right data. Because there's value at stake here. A lot of these query results that we're sending to smart contracts are like, who should receive a lending, you know, who should get a loan on chain, who should get a decentralized lending opportunity, things like what's the price of a crypto option, of a perp or a European settled option, things, you know, hell, what is the price of an actual asset itself, and if that price is wrong or an aggregation on that price is wrong, it's gonna mint value on chain for a hacker. What I'm getting at is having just a global network of decentralized nodes solves half the problem. A ZK proof solves the other half. And then we realize, there's still a third issue, which is data privacy now. Well, everything I just described works great for public data. Now, finally, we bring in Sotero to solve the last piece of this, which is not just public data, but also do all these operations on private encrypted data for the enterprise.
Okay. And who today, as it stands, I both want to ask you kind of two questions. One is, and they dance together. Really, I want to know, like, how far along are you guys in, like, real world value delivering? And then who loses? Like, what's the old technology that is going to, you know, fight and kick and scream on the way out? Is it like Google and Amazon, AWS? Is that, or do you view them as like they're going to become more competitive? Help me walk through like the landscape of how is this going? Who's, yeah, what are the competitors? And
yeah, thanks. Thank God. I mean, we are working with some of the largest pharmaceuticals, some of the largest telcos, and some of the financial services companies, all around preserving the privacy of data in of attributes in a database, to be very simplistic, right? Use cases span across protecting clinical trial data that's being shared, both internally and externally, GDPR compliance, the residency requirement of enabling organizations to collect data in the EU, store it in the US, and be confident that they're not going to be under pressure either from administration or from their consumers of keeping the data protected. We also enable revenue analytics for one of the largest telco companies, where they collect petabyte amounts of data on a monthly basis that they run revenue analytics.
And so you say you're working with, is that you have like 10 customers paying like 10 grand a month kind of scale? Like, can you mention revenue or customers or how are you?
I mean, think of $1 million relationships on an annual basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The complexity in the technology aspect of it is great, right? What we enable them across the board is meeting business outcomes, reducing the latency that it takes to move all this data and put all these safeguards in place. Because with this, you can still move at the speed of business without having to spend huge amounts of time moving data back and forth and putting all these additional products as safeguards, whether it's on-disk encryption, privilege management, et cetera.
Got it. So it sounds like the pitch might be, hey, large healthcare company, stop using AWS and start using us because it's more secure.
Yeah.
Is that in a nutshell? Yeah.
I think something that helped me understand the value prop of Sotero when I first started talking with Brander and understanding the incredible technology they've built is, you know, I was like, hey, what these centralized analytic black boxes that are centralized databases. It's a similar question, Mike, that you asked me at the beginning of this podcast. Hey, Brander, decentralized databases in the cloud, like, aren't they already kind of locked down? Don't they already kind of have their own firewall in the cloud? Aren't they behind their own SOC 2 compliant kind of user role-based access rules and user access rules? And Brander's answer was, well, sure, but there's so much more security needed. We hear about breaches all the time where, you know, an organization followed all what they thought was all the rules. And these are not like boring old, you know, 1970s era banks. We're talking about modern high-tech companies that all of us use on a daily basis. Just look at the news, that are getting breached and their data is, they thought their data was encrypted on disk, or they thought they had followed SOC 2 compliance, or they thought they'd done everything right, but that's still not enough. You there's additional security never hurts.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the complexity of the systems. That's the big challenge, right? I mean, when you think about a system, there's no isolated system. Every system, every network is interacting or integrated with hundreds, if not thousands, of different applications and endpoints. Centralizing, writing data to disk encrypted doesn't solve the problem of one, if not, or many of those people getting into the network and getting access to the data. If that happens, your disk level encryption is useless. Your firewall is useless. How do you protect?
And then from a space and time perspective, we can't lock this infrastructure down because it's not all owned by space and time. Sure, space and time is going to be deploying some percentage of the nodes in the network because we have to. But then a larger percentage will be deployed by the community. We don't have access to lock down a firewall around that data. We can't put a SOC 2 compliant wall around those other infrastructure nodes in the network, those other systems in the network. Sure, we'll put a SOC 2 compliant wall around our own and our own rules around our own nodes in the network. But Sotero comes in to help encrypt the data before it's sent out to all those other non-locked down nodes operated by the community. Without Sotero, we wouldn't be able to actually do any computations on private data. Space and time would have to tell our developer community, you can only use public transparent data when you use space and time, which is great. We encourage that, but that's only half of our use case. The other require private encrypted data.
And Scott, so where do you see the line between maybe a traditional infrastructure development and this Web3 DeFi word that gets thrown around? Is that just the number of computers or servers that, I mean, you say nodes, is nodes and servers interchangeable? It's just like a room with large computers and fans?
Functionally, sure. I think that's a purist would argue, you know, a node is a specific server. I'm saying a node is just one component of the network, a little Kubernetes cluster of servers. You're right. You asked the question a minute ago, like, is Amazon a competitor? Are the clouds your competitors? Who are you fighting against? It's not the clouds. I think the clouds themselves are just, the major hypervisors are just offering servers. I mean, most of Ethereum runs on AWS. Ethereum's not competing with AWS. In fact, if anything, AWS is a conduit to enabling Ethereum. And you know, we have a very tight partnership with Microsoft, but yet we're deploying space and time clusters everywhere. Tencent, AWS, soon Google. Of course, a lot of our infrastructure is on Azure. We believe Azure is leading the charge of confidential compute, trusted encrypted environments, enclaves, future technology that will enable even more security for space and time, even more privacy for private keys and management of data. But what I'm getting at is the hypervisors themselves are not the competitors. The competitors are developers and companies that are building in a centralized analytic black box. Companies that are doing all of their processing of data in a way we don't even understand. Like if you just something as simple as Web2 credit scores, traditional credit scores. I'm not going to call out any credit score companies, but you know what I'm talking about. How do they come up with that calculation? Sure, there might be some consortium that came up with a model for exactly how your credit score should be modeled. But why do all four of the credit score companies give you a different answer when you look up your credit score, Mike? Because it's an analytic black box. You have no idea how they're processing the data. You don't know whether it's accurate. You don't know whether someone from Experian logged in and like changed one row of data and could have manipulated your credit score. And that's one little example. Think about larger examples where money is transferred on chain at the scale of millions or billions of dollars. How do you know that's coming from an off-chain world that's accurate? We're talking to so many different like options trading protocols on chain that are building DeFi options, decentralized options on chain, but they're doing their options calculations to calculate the price of those derivatives off chain. Where is the confidence that those calculations are being executed correctly before they're being brought on chain? Space and time brings visibility and transparency to that through decentralization. But Zotero allows developers building on space and time to still keep private information that needs to be private, and keep public information that should be public and transparent public before it's brought on chain.
Got it. Okay. And so from a user's perspective, like the people who are trading options in your example, they are going to feel the benefit from this in the confidence that they have in the data not being hacked. I mean, is hacks like the primary problem this all solves?
Hacks in multiple senses of the word.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, so Zotero, I'll let Prander talk in a minute about how the type of hack that Zotero prevents. At a high level, like Zotero's preventing breaches of data, people mm-hmm. stealing private sensitive data.
Right.
Space and Time's technology, RZK proof of SQL, prevents a hack of people logging into the database and just changing a few rows of data to, as an example, manipulate the prices of options before they're brought on chain, or manipulate a credit score before it's brought on chain. We're not preventing people stealing data. In fact, we're trying to open up and make data transparent. We're preventing people manipulating data, changing the values. So Zotero prevents the stealing of that data. Go ahead, Brandon.
Scott, that was perfect, right? I mean, the portion that, like you said, it's interesting the way Scott put it, right? It's both a platform to enable public adoption, right? And a platform to enable you to move your private data with confidence that the data's security and the privacy is not violated. They're kind of like conflicting objectives, but that's essentially what the partnership here is achieving.
Okay, so I'm curious to get your thoughts on this. Who is the primary suspect in this? So you have obviously hackers that want to steal credit card data, healthcare data, all sorts of data. They want to hold companies at ransom, like Target or a hospital or something. And then there's the government. To me, it feels like on the edges, those hackers, like, yeah, you know, build all the software, stop them. But the government's like a unique case where they're high risk, in my view, because they might just do something like, hey, we need to stop all bank transfers and we need to stop all crypto. Like just recently, the Signature Bank that was shut down, the crypto bank, they said the government made a mandate that said, oh, the company or the bank that buys Signature cannot reinstate the crypto functionality. Like crypto can't be a part of banking, basically. And so it feels like it's like we're moving closer and closer to the federal government recognizing that there's like a direct conflict of interest between having the cryptocurrency world operate and flourish and having control over the monetary policy. And, you know, as we saw with like the bailouts of the banks just last week, there's a lot of anxiety involved in keeping the U.S. banks solvent. And so the Federal Reserve has really two levers. They can raise interest rates, drop interest rates, or they can print money. But they can only print money as long as you don't have an easy escape route. And I was, quick aside, I was reading yesterday, there's this like 1930s rule where the government seized all the gold in this executive order, and they basically took everyone's gold because they wanted to have this control of the monetary currency. And I can see a similar thing happening. Bitcoin is the obvious, you know, poster child. Right now, we can move money back and forth between Coinbase, Kraken, Binance. There's a few of them. Do you see this technology being helpful in preventing tell me, Scott, your thoughts on this.
You're really asking two questions. You're highlighting two important topics. One is censorship resistance, and the other is private auditing of sensitive third-party banking information. The partnership of Space and Time and Sotero actually is trying to offer value in both of those spaces. Space and Time, as a global decentralized network of servers all across the world, many outside of the U.S. and many on clouds outside of the U.S. or private data centers outside of the U.S. operated by a global community of like-minded Web3 individuals, mostly miners, adults, but people that run partner.
Yeah. Got it.
That offers a level of censorship resistance around data that hasn't been seen before in the data warehousing space specifically. Do I think that, for example, 200 clusters globally is adequate to stop a government? Maybe not. We'll see. That's TBD. Maybe you need thousands. Maybe you need Ethereum or Bitcoin level of decentralization for true censorship resistance beyond any CBDC, central government, central bank control. That's half of what you're hitting on. The other half is around how do we ensure that the financial institutions that we're interacting with on a daily basis are liable and showing proofs of their reserves and proofs of their books, and they're doing things that are not fraudulent or harmful to the constituents of that financial institution. I'm not saying that SVB did anything fraudulent. What I'm saying is there's a way for in the DeFi world or in the future of banking that we're quickly heading towards, I see, for more transparency around what's happening on the books. So Terra would allow, you know, private sensitive third-party information to be shared via Space and Time from one bank to an auditor or from one financial consortium to another. There's a way to lock down and encrypt that data where only the consortium of auditors that have the private keys can look. And that's important from a private sensitive third-party data auditing perspective. But from a transparency perspective, we can also bring more transparency to this financial space, open the books up and say, hey, here's my proof of reserves. Here's my proof of my bond assets that I'm holding. Like so many of these collapses recently, both in DeFi, CeFi, and in banking, I should really say CeFi and banking, have been via not these financial institutions not being transparent. Mm. Brander, I'd love your thought.
You touched on one point that's really important, Scott. There's two different perspectives to what you brought up, Mike, right? I mean, taking over like the Signature Bank stuff and saying, mandating that he can do something or threatening to take something over, right? There's two aspects to it. One is infrastructure. The second one is data. The infrastructure, even if they can't take over the infrastructure, most governments can put some kind of pressure on that, right? Like, we're going to eliminate access to it or we're going to cut off basic internet connectivity, right? So you can't operate. That's one threat. The second threat is access to the data, which is all the GDPR noise about, right? Giving the government access to consumer citizen information about EU citizens. that piece of it is what we also solve through this, right? That access to the data is essentially driven by what Scott brought up. It's the private keys or the encryption keys. In our solution, the encryption keys or the keys are owned by the owner of the data, not by the service provider, like with a Microsoft or with an Apple, where the government can go to Microsoft and Apple and force them to decrypt the data so they can get access to it. What we do is saying, you're the owner of the data, you have the keys. You're going to be the one that's making a decision on whether you want to share this with somebody or not share this with somebody. So even if somebody got hold of the infrastructure, whatever authority it is, does not have access to the data.
Got it. Okay. Do you feel this tension in I don't know if conflict is the right word, but that there's an obvious tension between owning, buying, trading, selling goods and assets using cryptocurrency versus using it with fiat USD? Certainly, you know, I think we'd all agree that the U.S. global reserve currency is being put under increased pressure. People outside the U.S. have far less incentive to even hold USD because they don't pay taxes in USD. I mean, one thing, if you live in the U.S., you have to have USD in a bank account. You have to pay taxes. And so there is like a common denominator there. Whereas if you're in another country, you know, like El Salvador is a good one that just recognized BTC as a national currency. So they presumably would accept taxes in that. They could have the whole system running on that. The U.S. government probably is going to be super slow to move in that direction because they own the printing press. They own the, you know, they own the printing machine. I just wonder if we're moving forward, like a space and time and Sodero moving forward. Like to me, it seems like this time over the next five-ish years, 5 to 10 maybe, is the time when all the smartest people building on DeFi and Web3 and all this cool encryption technology should be moving towards building an infrastructure that is highly resistant to government seizure. Because if government came in tomorrow and said, hey guys, like you can't use Bitcoin, we're going to shut down all the exchanges, no banks are allowed to use crypto, like it immediately hurts both of your, I would imagine, right? It's got to negatively impact your businesses and probably the whole ecosystem. And so what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, you're once again asking like three or four questions in one, and they're great questions. Like I think we can wrap here. Like to answer a few of the three, Sotero and Space and Time are not blockchains. We are not cryptocurrencies.
Fair point.
So we have some level of immunity to the ups and downs and swells of crypto. And Sotero itself is a data privacy company, data encryption company. Yeah. So Parander's business is helping organizations across Web2 and Web3, name your across DeFi, CeFi, and everything else, keep data private. So he's not at the whims of government regulation around crypto, whereas Space and Time is a little closer to that, right? We are playing primarily in the Web3 space. We are helping DeFi organizations and CeFi organizations connect, you know, data to smart contracts and process data in a more tamper-proof way. So we're a little closer to that world. And sure, we're not a cryptocurrency. We're not a blockchain. We're a decentralized data warehouse. But we do intend to drop a token at some point when the time's right, when I can do so with some confidence that I'm not going to get put in prison from the SEC or something. I'm saying that jokingly. But at the same time, like I think we're going to see the few chains adequately decentralized prior to this government intervention from the U.S., those few chains, Bitcoin, Ethereum, and maybe one or two more, I don't know, that have enough global validators outside of just AWS, U.S. availability zones, right, that could actually maintain a global reserve currency or a global gold, if you will. Like, you know, I think you saw a big uptick in Bitcoin price as soon as all the news about SVB, Signature, and others going down. That was a big boon for Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin popped. Why? Because people saw that as, weirdly, now Bitcoin is a safer reserve currency than bond. Like, and that creates a global market that people can move currency nearly instantly on chain. But the last thing I'll say is, that's probably only applies to the chains that have sufficiently decentralized prior to all of this happening.
Good point. Brandar, did you want to comment on that? I just find it so interesting and so important, this, inevitable conflict of interest.
Well, yeah, I think, there's just a lot of, it's only times in that space, right? I think the government The U.S. government, for example, is still trying to figure out how to adapt to it. Is it inevitable? You brought up Ecuador, and they're jumping on the bandwagon. I mean, they're doing it because it's beneficial to them at this point. We've also seen China put a lot of crimps on digital currency because it doesn't suit them. And it limits their ability to manipulate or manage their currency. It's evolving time, and I think Scott brings up a great point. It's the ones that have sufficient size today that are going to survive in the future. That size gives them credibility. I think in some ways, the SVB crisis is also demonstrating the real value of that alternative currency.
Yeah.
So it's early times. I think there's a lot that needs to evolve, but the technology to do distributed data warehousing, the need for data security or privacy is not going away, regardless of what framework the world decides to adopt.
Yeah. If anything, this might be honestly kind of good for Sotero in space and time, as more while we go toward more transparency, we also move toward the need for privacy for things that need to be private.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's why I asked the question, is that it seems like I try to take a step back from good and bad. Like, is it bad if the Federal Reserve prints so much money so quickly that the USD is inflated and loses its dominant position as a global reserve currency? Is it good or bad? I don't know, but it's going to happen. I mean, it's happened to the Dutch Empire, to the Roman Empire, to the British Empire. It's probably going to happen again to the US Empire in the next, I don't know, right? You familiar with like Ray Dalio's Rise and Falls of Empires? It's like, we're just talking about timing here. These things tend to move slow and then really fast all at once. So I think the really fast all at once probably didn't start, but man, last week was crazy. I mean, yeah. It could have, it's like, you can see how the tinderbox is there. And, you know, I don't have to show you guys, but some of the graphs on like the debt, and it's like, it points to a situation where, yes, maybe it's early, but maybe a lot happens in the third inning. And I like to think of these things as like, you don't know what's going to happen, but you can fairly accurately understand the high level incentives, because they don't change very fast. Like, the Fed has like two levers. It's not overly complicated. The second order effects are quite complicated. Maybe the political landscape changes and that introduces more complexity. But at the end of the day, regardless of what political parties in power, there still is a desire of the centralized government to maintain control of the monetary flow. And that's why I just think, like, what are we doing enough? Like, am I excited about the progress on the DeFi front that at least preserves the freedom of money, right? Like, this country was started on the premise of freedom of speech, because, you know, in Britain, like, they had a king and you really couldn't say what you wanted. And so, like, freedom of money might be...
I think you're bringing up valid points, and forgive my interruption here.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a roller coaster of feelings and emotions from different political groups in the United States, right? Not everyone is pro-crypto and not everyone is anti-crypto. Mm-hmm. There's different parties that have different viewpoints, different motivations. And I think your whole, like, what you're bringing up is like, you know, we were founded on freedom of speech. Why can't we have freedom of currency? I kind of get it. Like, I want DeFi and CeFi, frankly, to boom. I believe in Web3. I believe in this future of decentralized technology that facilitates decentralized finance and a global kind of a new Swift, if you will. But I can see the motivations of regulators. And I can see the fraud that's been happening within the Web3 space. And I can see the motivations of regulators to want more tight control and make the US dollar more important than Bitcoin. I get that. I think as political parties move left and right and fight and change and things, there's going to be a roller coaster. DeFi is not going away. It may temporarily be potentially even outlawed in the US for a short period of time, before that changes back the other direction. Globally, DeFi has won. Bitcoin and Ethereum have decentralized. They have adequate censorship resistance. They are not going away. In the US, for a short period of time, TBD.
That's actually a good perspective. It's like, it really is such a global world. And these things aren't going to happen all at once. Even if the US puts pressure on other companies to say, hey, you also have to ban Bitcoin mining, I mean, do you see, Scott, in that scenario that the U.S. global influence could expand to be a significant threat? Obviously, if it just was in the U.S. borders, but realistically, they would put pressure on.
Sure. Yeah. Look, anything's possible. But my opinion, and humble opinion, is that anything's possible for a short period of time before it swings back the other way. True. And, you know, with that, Mike, it's been an absolute pleasure talking. And I appreciate all the great questions, both on the tech side and on the commentary on what's happening in crypto right now. Because it's, on one hand, it's a little terrifying. On the other hand, it presents an opportunity for us to, when things swing back the other way, really fix things when they swing back the other way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And Prendar, Scott, where are you guys on the internet personally? Are you tweeting, blogging, anything you want to throw out there on the personal side?
Sure. A quick plug for the Space and Time Twitter and Space and Time Disc, Space and Time DB on Twitter. Also, our Discord's popping off for developers and folks in the community that want to start building on Space and Time. We're close to an open beta, likely in May, and we're really excited about that. I'm at Scott Dykstra on Twitter and would love to talk if you're interested in building on the decentralized future.
Sweet. And Prendar, we'll have all the links to the company in the show notes. I'm sure similar to Scott there. Did you want to mention anything on the...
Sure. Company is at Sotero Secure, and I personally am at Das GP.
What's the GP?
It's my name shortened.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Love it. Guys, really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks so much. And I wish you guys continued luck on all the endeavors.
Hey, thanks so
much.
Thank
you, Mike. Thanks for having us. Scott, always a pleasure to talk to you.
You as well, Prendar. Take care, my friends.
See ya. Yep.